and welcome to the 57th edition of the House of Comments podcast. One more and we'll have more flavours than Heinz. I'm delighted to be back. My name's Emma Burnell and I am a Labour blogger. I blog at the Scarlet Standard. And I'm here with Lib Dem blogger Mark Thompson, my regular co-host. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
And I'm delighted today to be joined by Laura Wilkes, who is a Labour activist and an expert in local government.
Hi.
Hi, Laura. So you can imagine what we will be starting off talking about today. So, not much interesting to come out of that one then. Laura, talk us through what happened on Thursday.
Well, actually, I think it was quite an interesting day.
No, absolutely. I was being sardonic.
Clearly. I mean, we have, you know, the rise of UKIP. They now have, 147 councillors, which is quite remarkable given that they were predicted to have 40 or 50 overall. Mm-hmm. I think that Labour were, you know, in many ways very successful at this election, despite others probably saying not so much. And it was probably, I think, not the greatest day for the Tories. Mm. They lost a few councils to no overall control and a significant number of councillors.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Did they lose more than were predicted by the Rawlings and Thrasher numbers?
I'm not sure. I think it was about on what was predicted, actually.
So I know we didn't quite achieve what they were predicting for us, although we did manage to beat our own expectation management figures.
Yes.
What a surprise.
And the Lib Dems, Laura, how was it for them?
Do you know what? I just think it was kind of a non-election for the Lib Dems. What really happened for them? They are now kind of sharing being the third largest party with UKIP. There are questions about what is going to happen to the Lib Dems in local government in the future. They're sort of already fairly off the map. And after Thursday, not much has changed. I mean, in some ways, the elections were quite extraordinary because of the rise of UKIP. Mm. But on the other hand, actually, when you look at the local government map, not that much has changed.
Okay. Mark, what's the feeling inside the Lib Dems at the moment?
Well, if you listen to the party spokespeople, they seem to think that we've not done too badly. We've probably done better than a lot of people were thinking. The old expectation management game again, which I'm getting very, very tired of that whole thing, to be honest. It's incredibly tedious to have, you know, politicians saying, well, we didn't do as badly as some people said we were going to do. Well, yeah. I don't really care about who said what how you were going to do. How have you done? Never mind about what the expectations were. It's not a great story. We lost 120 something seats, I think. We're left with about 350 something. Now, one of the things that I keep hearing again party spokespeople saying is that basically we've held up in our strongholds, you know, in the places where we have MPs, we've done pretty well. And I think from the projections I've seen, if what had happened nationally, we'd hold about 50 of our 57 seats. But I'm not convinced about this because I'm sure Laura can perhaps expand on this in a more general way across all the parties. But I don't think people vote in local elections in the same way as they'll vote in national elections. And I think there are a lot of Lib Dem councillors who probably do really good stuff in local areas. Maybe, you know, there's a kind of, you know, a vote for them as local councillors. I suspect quite a lot of the leaflets that went out probably didn't big up the Lib Dem side of things too much and had such and such a person, your local campaigner, with a tiny little Lib Dem logo in the bottom left-hand corner or something. So I'm not convinced that we can really read much into the national picture from these elections. And another thing that really irritates me is these are supposed to be local elections. They're supposed to be fought
for
local
issues.
And yet all the coverage has been about what this means for the national picture and the national party leaders. It drives me nuts, but, you know, it's like spitting in the wind. I'll say the polite version to try and do anything about that. I suppose you just got to go with it. But overall, it's not a great picture for the Lib Dems. Having said that, I don't think anyone particularly expected it to be a great picture. That I'm doing the expectation management game now. did you see that?
That was very good, Mark. Slickly done.
Thank you.
Just on that point about do people vote the same in local elections as they do national ones, I think what you tend to see is that people, you know, once the you know, the Tories getting nationally, then the local government map tends to go Labour, vice versa. I think people do tend sometimes to use it as a protest vote, and perhaps why UKIP did so well was because they picked up the protest vote. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
I think it, you know, it is sad that this was a set of local elections and it has been so dominated by national issues.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And things that UKIP campaign on are not things that can be dealt with by a local councillor. I mean, your local councillor is not going to stop immigration or get us out of the EU, however much they would like to.
And one thing I'm not entirely clear on is, you know, what did the UKIP candidates, what did they stand for when it came to particular local issues? So things like planning, things like the cleaner, greener, safer agenda, which we know are real kind of bread and butter local government issues. Where did they stand on those? I'm not entirely clear on that.
No. I know they did get quite a lot of support around the HS2 issue, coming out against the HS2 line and where that's planned development.
Yeah, I think that there was actually quite a lot of evidence that in the areas that are directly affected by HS2, that there was a very, very strong UKIP vote. So I think that's one of those issues that I suppose you could sort of argue is a local issue, because, you know, obviously it's affecting local areas. Obviously it's a national policy, but it has local effects. And I think I said this on the podcast a few weeks ago. I think UKIP are getting very good at actually picking up on these local issues. They actually remind me of the way the Lib Dems campaign in local areas. They pick up on these local issues and they just go with them and go with them and go with them. And of course, Lib Dems always used to be able to be opposed to whatever the national policy was at a local level. A lot harder for them to do that now. And I think that's one of the things that UKIP are picking up on and have learned from other smaller parties like the Lib Dems. Mm-hmm. So in terms of UKIP not having a coherent national set of policies, absolutely. And I don't think even they would claim otherwise. But I think you can get a very long way in local elections without a coherent national platform, just by picking these local issues that you can campaign strongly on. So I think that's an effect we're seeing. I think they're getting smarter at being local campaigners, which is perhaps worrying for their opponents like me and like everyone else in this podcast, I suspect.
I just wanted to go back to something you said earlier, Mark, which was I've seen it too, lots and lots of people from the Lib Dems pushing the line that you're doing better where you have MPs.
Yeah.
But I saw John Curtis, who is, you know, the very well-respected suffragist, saying that actually you're losing about 13% in those areas.
Yeah.
As opposed to 12% nationally. It's just that you had that space to lose that within some of these seats.
Yeah.
Would you say that there's a slight, again, expectation management or troop management going through with that message?
Yeah, I would do. I mean, having said that, we saw in Eastleigh that we were just able to hold on. Now, I'm not going to oversell that, because we came bloody close to losing the seat, let's be honest. And we poured how many thousand activists into that seat over the course of the 3 or 4 week campaign. You know, we just managed to hold it. So I actually don't think you can really read that much from this as to what's going to happen at a general election. But I think, I do think that there is, let me be kind, I'll say a certain level of optimism in some of the statements that I've seen coming out, because yes, you're right. I think we had the buffer there, and I think also UKIP was taking votes away from the Tories. Now maybe that will be our saviour, because a lot of our seats, the second place candidate are the Tories. And if UKIP's vote can hold up in the way that it held up here and it can take enough votes from the Tories, maybe that will help us keep enough Lib Dem MPs, maybe even gain the odd other one somewhere. I mean, very odd things can happen in the first past the post when, blocks of votes, you know, the vote on the right suddenly gets split in this way. You know, we saw it in the 1980s with the SDP, all kinds of crazy things can happen. So it's just impossible to say. But yeah, I think we probably are being too optimistic. But having said that, surprise, surprise, you know, that's what happens after elections. You get politicians going on the media and they try and spin it in the best way they possibly can.
Yeah, I think all the parties are guilty of doing that. I mean, I think that Labour had a decent night. I wouldn't like to call it a good night. I don't think it was good enough.
I would disagree. I think we had a very successful night, actually. When you look at the areas that were up for election, I mean, we're talking about the Tory shires. It's not traditionally places where Labour would always do well. So I think, you know, we've now got more councillors than we had in 2003. We gained nearly 300 seats. We took control of two places.
Yeah.
We won two mayoral elections, which traditionally Labour aren't very good at winning those sort of elections. So, I actually think that is successful.
I don't think it was unsuccessful. I think maybe there is a place that you need to be mid-term in order to win the next election to get the momentum going that we didn't quite reach. We were nearly there, but not quite there. Having said that, I think our targeting has been absolutely superb. And where you look at where we have picked up local seats, in and around those island seats, those early selections, all the seats that we're targeting on that list of 106 seats, that was where, that's clearly where work's being done. And so I think in terms of this election, I don't feel the momentum was quite there yet, and I'd like to see us kick up our campaigning a gear. But I do think that the strategy in terms of targeting has been absolutely superb.
Yeah, I mean, if we are to win in 2015, we will need to be winning in places like Amber Valley, in Lincoln, in Norwich, and actually that is where we did well on Thursday.
Yeah, Amber Valley, Norwich, Stevenage, which I have, my heart doesn't quite reside in Stevenage, but my parents do. so places like that we did very well in. So hopefully, fingers crossed. And I think next year we'll see when the urban seats go, we'll maybe see a little bit more of how we might perform in the seats where it's a Lib Dem Labour contest.
See,
because I think a lot of our targets are that way inclined.
I would agree with that, yeah.
And I certainly, from stuff we've seen in, for example, in London during the mayoral elections, the list system, the Lib Dems, even in their most comfortable seats, were absolutely devastated. How much the individual MPs can save that? Mark, what do you think?
Having said everything I said a little bit earlier on, I wouldn't underestimate the power of incumbency. I know that our MPs, I think of a couple of very striking examples, people like Tim Farron. He has absolutely embedded himself in the Lake District area that he lives and represents. And he took it from, a seat I think that was, we might have been third, we certainly didn't hold the seat, to winning the seat. And I think his majority is now about 12,000 or something. He's just worked that patch incessantly. He's never away from the doorsteps. And I think that's reflected in quite a lot of Lib Dem constituencies. So I do think that we have a decent chance of retaining quite a few of our seats, but I think things are a lot more volatile than we'd be prepared to admit. And I can't really say much more than that. I know that we're very, very good at digging in and staying dug in. I think Tim Montgomery, I saw him once describe us as the bindweed of politics, that once we get in somewhere, you can't get rid of us. And I think I took that as a compliment, frankly, from him.
I mean, that will be the kind of interesting thing to look at with UKIP is, can the success they've had in these local elections translate at the next general election? How are they going to actually perform in their councils on a day-to-day basis? Will they be able to influence policy? I think it will be really interesting to see whether they have longevity.
Yeah, I've seen some comments about this, and frankly, some of it that I've seen I found slightly patronising. There seems to be an assumption that these people will get into, become councillors, having never done it before, and then, won't do very well, we'll cock it up, basically, and then they'll be shown to be, not good representatives, and, people will just vote them out next time. And I don't necessarily think that's true. I think lots of people who get elected councillors, certainly for the first time, don't really know what they're doing, of all parties. And they find their feet after a few months or a year, and then they get on with it. And I don't really see why it's necessarily going to be any different for UKIP councillors. If anything, we might see the opposite sort of effect, that that they're so grateful that they didn't expect it, that they actually will work really hard to stay in. I don't think we can really predict what's going to happen in that respect. But I think this default assumption that, they're a bunch of wrong'uns and they're bound to mess it up, I'm not convinced that's going to happen.
I don't think, for me, it's that they're bound to mess up being councillors. Some of them will probably do it well, some of them will probably do it badly.
Yeah, a bit like across all parties.
Yeah, but the problem is what they were campaigning on and what they can deliver and the yawning gap between those two things.
It depends what they were campaigning on in local areas, doesn't it? Because just because the National Party's saying one thing, you know, what were their individual platforms in the wards where they stood?
I think you have a rather rosy-eyed view of how connected people are to the election of their local councillor and how much of the information they take in that their local councillor is giving them.
Well, possibly, but that's the mandate that they've got, isn't it? So, you know.
Yes, but if they have campaigned on no immigration and immigration continues to rise, then that means that the people who voted for them in frustration are not going to see any payback for their vote.
Yeah, but
vote something if you're not getting payback on
but
it?
But I don't think people are stupid enough to think that councillors can make a difference to immigration. What instead they might think is, well, we voted them in locally and, you know, the councillor can quite rightly turn around and say, I can't do anything about immigration, but if you vote UKIP for the national elections and we get enough MPs, we can do something about it. So if anything, it might have the opposite effect of what you're thinking. People might think, well, they got in the council, why don't we try and get them in Westminster now to really do the job that we want them to do? If that's why people are voting UKIP, but I think that's actually a big if. I think there are all kinds of reasons why people are voting UKIP. It's a classic protest vote. It's the kind of vote that Lib Dems used to hoover up. So it's not surprising that the leakage is coming not just from the Conservatives, but from all parties. And this idea now that you're getting bubbling up from the Tory backbenches, right, we've got to have the referendum on the EU membership immediately. And we've got to have a crackdown on immigration. It's like, it's not responding to what's happened in a sensible way, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm. But UKIP there have been hugely successful in shifting the debate.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's say they go on in 2015 and if they can say, well, look, we've managed to influence Tory policy, look how effective we are, then I actually think people might be more likely to vote for them again because they've seen that they've been really successful in shifting the debate on to what they care about.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Laura. And I think that's actually the big risk here. Mm. I mean, we already saw what happened with Cameron, where he made his EU speech. He promised a referendum in 2017. All the Tories were going on about how they'd shot UKIP's fox. Next thing you know, they got 20-odd% in the local elections. Mm. All it did is legitimise their platform and make people more likely to vote for them. And I think the more red meat that the right-wing Tories are thrown, the better UKIP will do. I'm absolutely convinced of it. It's like, you know, they say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing repeatedly and expecting different results. Why do they expect it to be any better? All they're doing is making pumping up Farage, making him seem more and more and more important and relevant doing that.
Well, I mean, up to and including the point that you've got Jacob Rees-Mogg and Peter Bone today and Dan Hannan all over the media calling for a pact between UKIP and the Tories at the next general election.
Yeah, a pact that would have been unnecessary if we'd have got AV. But anyway.
I should have warned you about this, Laura.
Yeah, move on.
Well, no, Daniel Hannan did a piece for The Telegraph the other day where he was going on and on about how, you know, people who want what UKIP wants, they should be sensible and vote for the Tories because the Tories are the ones who can actually give it. And it would be terrible if a once-in-a-generation chance for voters to get the referendum on the EU that they want could be stymied because so many people vote for UKIP that the Tories don't get in and therefore Labour gets in. And it's just the age-old argument of don't vote for X party because Y party might get in, vote for us instead. It's pathetic. And it really would have been obviated by it.
X can't win here.
Yeah, exactly, but you know why the Dems do that all the time. It's the classic squeeze because it's first past the post. And anyway, that is just a fact. But I mean, realistically, I can't. UKIP aren't going to be interested in any kind of pact. They're the insurgents.
Farage has said he'll do it if Cameron will step down. I don't think Cameron's going anywhere, but it would be hilarious if that's what happened because Cameron is the Tory party's biggest asset.
Farage would be an absolute fool to do that. From where he is at the moment, he's you know, his party's the insurgent party. They can pick up all these protest votes. What's going to happen if he's suddenly in league with the main governing party? His party would cease to exist within short order. It would just be subsumed into the Conservatives. I can't believe he would want to do that. Otherwise, why didn't he just join the Tories in the first place and, you know, be one of...
You know, you sound like everybody I know shortly after the 2010 election talking about your lot.
Really?
Yeah. Why didn't he just join the Tories anyway?
Well, no, it's not quite the same because our policies really weren't that similar to the Tories. But actually, I think quite a lot of UKIPers would claim that their policies aren't so similar to the Tories in a number of other respects. So they're not the same party. This is the thing, you know, and actually it's not good for plural democracy to have, you know, to have parties kind of considering, well, should we kind of join together? Should we have a pact? That's not democracy, really. If people want to vote for what UKIP can offer, they should vote for UKIP. They shouldn't be forced to vote for the Tories.
Or... Playing devil's advocate, though, isn't it more democratic to indicate who you might have a pact with before an election than for that to be worked out in a back room after the election?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think countries that have a kind of more mature PR systems, you know, systems that have been in place for quite a while, so coalitions are the norm, do have that sort of thing. We don't in this country, just because we hadn't had a coalition for so long that there was no, you know, no one ever really thought it was going to happen, I think. And then obviously it did happen. I hope that there is a bit more thought put into what happens pre-election in terms of what red lines are and who you may or may not go into coalition with after the election. But it is true, under first past the post, that's a very difficult thing to do, because as soon as you start saying stuff like that, your vote gets massively squeezed and the stakes are so much higher under first past the post, because a couple of percentage points here and there can make such a massive difference to the number of seats that you get. So it's a very difficult thing to do.
I think we've probably done UKIP and the local elections to death. And I'm sure that this time next year we'll all be talking about a very similar topic, having done the European elections, where I suspect they'll get about 90% of the vote.
Oh, that's good expectation management there, Emma. Well,
that's lower than the number I got depressingly told by someone else. So there you go. I'm rounding down.
I have to say though, Farage was very brave, because he was predicting 14%, and it turned out they got 23%.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he went out slightly out on a limb. Maybe he knew something we didn't.
Let's assume that David Cameron is still the leader of the Tories, at least for now. One of the other big stories of this week has been the questioning of David Cameron's judgment when it comes to hiring people to advise him. He's brought several new people into his circle, and of those several of them are old Etonians. White, male, posh. All the things that David Cameron was missing from all his advisors previously. What do we think about this, and how do we think it might be improved? Laura?
Oh, well, I think we couldn't have expected anything less, really. I think that, you know, he's hired people that he knows, hired people who are broadly representative of his views and where the Tory party are. And, you know, how to improve it? Well, I think the answer's pretty obvious. They need to look wider than their own circle of chums, really. But I suspect they're not in a place where they're really brave enough to do that at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's a couple of factors at play here. Firstly, Cameron is by nature very cliquey anyway. I mean, you know, I've heard him described as an incredibly loyal friend to people, which I suppose in some respects is a good characteristic to have, if that's true. Having said that, I do think you have to have a certain flash of steel about you as a prime minister. And I think the way it's very clear that George Osborne's position is totally unassailable, I think is at least as much down to the fact that he's a very close friend of David Cameron's than it is about his abilities or skills or suitability for that role. So,
someone hopes so.
Yeah, it's a slightly double-edged thing. I think the other thing is we're probably starting to witness a little bit of the old bunker mentality, which seems to afflict all prime ministers eventually, and it seems to have afflicted this one perhaps sooner than most, just purely because of the political situation he finds himself in. So his natural inclination to surround himself with people like him and people who he feels he can trust is probably heightened by the fact that he likely does feel under siege a little bit from his right wing, from the Lib Dems, from the fact that he has nowhere to go in that respect, because he doesn't have a majority, so he has to compromise all the time. But having said all of that, I agree that it's not good that so many of his close circle are old Etonians and people who are exactly like him. I mean, you need a bit of grit in the oyster, don't you? Even just to challenge the... I can't believe that these situations where you have all these very, very privileged people sitting around don't result in some kind of groupthink. They must do. Because these people, they have... The life experiences are all incredibly similar to each other. I think that's how you can end up with situations like... I think we were talking about this on the podcast the other week, where they were trialling the new benefit system somewhere. And they were discovering that when you stop paying people weekly and start paying them monthly, that they struggle to cope with that situation, and they'd run out of money by the third week. And you know, and this wasn't just isolated. This was happening on a large scale. And it just felt to me like these people must have sat around and thought, well, why can't we pay them monthly? You know, people who earn money are paid monthly, so why not? And that will prepare them for the world of work, and that will be good for them. And these people just had no experience of the kind of chaotic lifestyles that some people who will be claiming these benefits live in. And yeah, I mean, that's just a little vignette, but maybe if they had more people who'd come from working class backgrounds, you know, like David Davis, for example. You know, he was brought up on a council estate by a single parent, but he's nowhere near the centre of power. I mean, I suppose it's unrealistic to expect he would be after everything that happened.
Yeah,
I mean, but they need people like him. Yeah, of course, but they need people like him. You know, then maybe one of the problems is they don't have many within...
enough people like him.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. Maybe the problem is that just within the Tory parliamentary party, there just aren't enough people like that.
I suspect that's part of the case, but what I find quite kind of alarming in some respects is the sort of total lack of awareness of how the rest of the world perceives their parliamentary party. I mean, you know, it's sort of a running joke now about the number of members of cabinet who are millionaires, but that's actually, you know, that is true. And I just find it quite worrying that they can't take a step back and think, you know, we're not representative of the broader population, and we need to do something about that, because it's really important to have representation from all walks of life.
I think this indicates, I mean, there are two problems that this government has, and in particular that the Conservative part of this government has. The first is they believe that announcing is doing. So, for example, when when Cameron first came to government, announced that a third of his cabinet would be women, everyone went, yay, a third of your cabinet will be women. I think three of his cabinet are women, yeah, which ain't a third, because his cabinet keeps getting so big that they've had to extend the table. You know, they've got, so that's one real issue, is that they genuinely just go, oh, we've announced it, that will make it happen. And that just is so, it's a thing that happens to people in government, but it's a bad thing, and it's not something that should be allowed to go unremarked. The second is that Cameron is almost entirely focused on managing the Conservative Party and his relationship with the Conservative Party, and very, very unfocused on his relationship with the country, which is why he keeps doing things like this and, you know, bringing in someone like Joe Johnson, which was such an obvious manoeuvre to try and neutralise the Boris effect, try and, you know, wind Boris up and neutralise the issues among his backbenchers who like Boris. And it's just, you know, it's short-term tactics, no long-term strategy. And has lost the focus of running the country, which, considering the state that they're running the country into, is a real problem.
Yeah, and just as a little aside here, actually, until this week, I mean, maybe this is remiss of me, maybe I should have been aware of it, but I wasn't even aware that Boris Johnson's brother was in the House of Commons. And it maybe slightly fits in with this pattern in a slightly different way. You know, so two brothers, well, OK, actually, Boris Johnson isn't in the Commons at the moment, but he was in the Commons, and he'll probably end up back there at some point. And then you've got, obviously, David Miliband, Ed Miliband. You've got Yvette Cooper and Ed Balls.
David's no longer in the Commons.
Yeah, OK, but he only left a few weeks ago. You know what I'm saying?
We haven't mentioned, Mark, the South Shields by-election, by the way. Well, isn't that nice of us?
You missed your opportunity during the election discussion, so we'll move swiftly on. Yeah, we came seventh. I'm delighted. I don't think there's any way we can put a positive spin on that. What was I saying? Yeah, so there's even a kind of nepotism within the Commons as well. You know, I suppose it's always gone on, hasn't it? I mean, over the various decades, you have had other husbands and wives, and you've had brothers, and you've had fathers, and parents and children in there as well. But I don't think that says anything very good, really, because in a truly meritocratic system, you would expect you wouldn't really expect that to happen. So it's pretty clear that there's other factors at play as well, other than just complete suitability for the role. And maybe that kind of fits in with this. I don't know what percentage of MPs are from private school, but I know it's way higher than the proportion that are actually within the general population. I think in general population, it's about 8% or 9% of people go to private school. Yeah, and it's something like 30-odd% in the commons. And, you know, maybe that's part of the problem as well, but I don't know how you solve that.
I mean, in terms of how it looks from the outside, it was interesting there that you just said you didn't, you know, you only just found out that there were three women in the cabinet. And maybe the outside world genuinely don't see this as a problem. Maybe they, you know, they don't know who's in the cabinet, and frankly, they might not care who's in the cabinet. But I think, you know, there's still an underlying issue about when you're making decisions, you need people who are broadly representative of the population in order to make decisions that are going to be representative and kind of look after and look out for everyone. But maybe it doesn't matter. I don't know. Maybe from the public point of view, they don't care who's in the cabinet.
No, I think it does matter. I think it matters just for the way that decisions are taken. You know, if you don't have people with a wide, diverse range of experience. I mean, okay, so MPs should be having surgeries and be in touch with their constituents so that they can represent that. But you can't help your background and your upbringing. It's bound to inform, even subconsciously, your approach and your decision-making processes. So I do think that long-term, it's a bad idea to have people drawn from a very narrow social spectrum making these decisions. But having said that, like I said earlier on, I don't know what the solution is, because, you know, I guess lots of people who go to private school want to go into politics and aspire to high office. And I guess it was always thus.
I think they have to be much more proactive in seeking candidates who are different to what they already have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's also very instructive as to how the difference between, say, Jesse Norman, another old Etonian who's been hired to be one of these advisors now, and say Nadine Dorries. Now, I don't agree with anything Nadine Dorries has ever said, I don't think. I think she's, you know, a dreadful woman in terms of her political beliefs. But she has had the whip withdrawn for 6 months, was a very well-known rebel, probably wouldn't have had the whip withdrawn for going on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here if she hadn't already annoyed senior people in government. But Jesse Norman was the guy who led the revolt against House of Lords reform. And 6 months later, he's got a promotion. So, you know, if you're one of us, you can stand up to us. If you're not one of us, if you're a working class woman from Liverpool who annoys people, then other Tories, she absolutely, you know, they love her in equal measure, then, you know, you don't get on. And I think that's a real problem.
Was it Sarah Wollaston who was brought in on the open primary?
Yeah.
The doctor? Because, I mean, it would be interesting to understand what her experience has been of being an MP in that party for the last, two
She's
and a half
been
years,
very
years.
Outspoken about how poor this hiring practice has been.
Because I guess that was their real attempt to try and bring in someone who was different. Mm.
Yes, and I think that because she spoke out during the NHS bill controversies, and has been outspoken and independent, I think they may have had their fingers burnt.
Yeah, but that is so... I won't swear, but that is... She's a GP. You know, if... They haven't got that many GPs on their backbenches, the Tories. If the fact that she spoke out in an area that she knows a lot about has then been a black mark against her... So
I'm not
she...
saying it's right, Mark. I'm saying it's probably what happened.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right, actually. I have to say, you chose Nadine Dorries. I think you chose quite a bad example, because I wouldn't give Nadine Dorries a job doing anything.
I wouldn't give her a job doing anything. I might give her the whip back after 6 months.
Well, who knows? There's been rumours that she might be moving to another party soon.
Well,
so we'll see.
If they keep treating her the way she does, then UKIP are going to have their first MP.
Yeah, maybe it is that backbenchers who are outspoken then don't get preferment, but... Yeah, that's a structural problem to do with the way it works, isn't it? If you're a good little backbencher and you vote the way that you should do all the time, then eventually you'll be promoted. And I thought that these reforms to the select committees, trying to make the select committees more powerful, was supposed to be like an alternative career ladder for MPs, so that they could perhaps be more outspoken and maybe they then wouldn't get ministerial office, but they'd have another route that they could go down. But I think it's pretty it's pretty dreadful, really, that you've got to be. Well, except like you say, Jesse Norman, he was a rebel and he got promoted anyway. I don't know what the reason is. Well, maybe it is because he's one of us. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we've probably covered that. We will think it's bad, essentially. Pull your finger out, David Cameron, and hire someone decent. And by decent, we mean not an old Etonian. Okay, so this week has seen the news that Stuart Hall pleaded guilty to a number of charges of rape and sexual assault. And at the same time, has seen an MP face allegations and I believe arrest and is on bail, MP Nigel Evans, on charges of rape and sexual assault. The former case seems to have been a textbook case that would make the argument in favour of having somebody be able to be named as a suspect. It seems that a number of the people who came forward did so only after they'd heard that other people had done so with the Stuart Hall case. With the Nigel Evans case, obviously we don't know yet whether he is guilty, whether anything has happened. And a number of people are arguing that his case, because he's so high profile, he will never recover from this if he is found innocent, and makes the opposite case for rape suspects being able to remain anonymous. And it turns out it was actually in the coalition agreement that rape suspects would be, they would bring forward legislation to make rape suspects anonymous. Mark, where do you stand on this?
Well, my understanding is it is actually Lib Dem policy for that. I don't think it was Tory policy, but then it did end up in the coalition agreement, like you said. I think it was made policy before I was a member of the party. I joined in 2008, and I think I read this was made party policy in 2006.
Yeah.
So I don't remember it happening, but I'm not that surprised, because it does kind of fall into the whole civil liberties area, doesn't it? By instinct, I feel that it isn't right that there's an imbalance between the suspect and the victim in this kind of situation. But I do completely take the point about how often when someone is accused, other victims then are able to come forward or feel able to come forward, maybe because... you know, now that they realise that they're not the only one and they won't be on their own if they come forward. You know, maybe in some cases victims weren't even aware of who the person was or anything like that, but then they realise as well. But I'm very conflicted on this, you can probably tell. What's happened with Nigel Evans, I think, unless and until he is found guilty, and he may not be guilty, I do feel like his political career has now basically been finished. But I hope I'm wrong about that. If it turns out that he isn't guilty of this crime, maybe this could be an example of where someone was named, and if it turns out that they are innocent, that maybe he can resume his career unimpeded. And I guess we'd have to wait and see about that. If I was to vote on this, I honestly don't know which way I would vote, I have to say. I'm very conflicted on it.
Laura, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think too, I can see arguments both ways, but I think what it comes down to is that the first concern has to be the victim actually of these crimes. And we already know that there are so many barriers to people coming forward in the first place. And would this just put another barrier in place? I wonder. Partly because I think, you know, if you do change the law around this, there's a certain sort of victim blaming around this. So, you know, if it weren't for the person reporting the rape in the first place, this wouldn't be a problem, would it? And I can't help but think that's going to discourage people from coming forward and speaking out on things like this. You know, not to mention the fact that it is true that, you know, in the case you mentioned, people did come forward once they heard that it happened to other people. And so I can't help but feel that this would be an additional barrier.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I mean, I think we there should be protections in place for people who are accused of crime. For example, there should be very strong workplace protections that they wouldn't, if for example, you're suspended on full pay while the investigation takes place, once the investigation is over, if you are not found guilty, you are therefore innocent and your job must be protected.
Yeah, and I think one of the problems, Emma, is that I know that there are cases where that hasn't happened, where people have lost their jobs and they've felt like they had to move house. It has destroyed their lives. And I think that's part of the problem here.
The idea that putting this forward just for rape, for people accused of rape, speaks to a narrative that is so false that people are more likely to be accused, falsely accused of rape than other crimes, which is absolutely disproven. Keir Starmer, mm-hmm. who was the Director of Prosecutions until quite recently, did a whole report on this last year. You know, it is a myth, and it is a myth that we propagate over and over again throughout society. And by putting this legislation in this way and singling out rape, what you are doing is sending a very strong message to victims that you will not be believed.
I think that's right. I think, you know, why should those accused of rape have kind of any more legal protections than any other crimes, if that makes sense? You know, there are other crimes that happen and people are fully aware of who committed those and who's been accused of those. So I sort of agree with that point, that if you single out rape in this way, then it will just discourage people from coming forward. I mean, we already know that something like 85% of rapes go unreported. And I think that's really shocking.
But I think the reason why, Laura, I'm not saying this is right, but I think the reason is because the victims are afforded anonymity. So the perception is that there is an imbalance in that respect, in that the potential perpetrator, the accused, doesn't get the same level of anonymity. But like I say, I mean, in the Stuart Hall case and also the Jimmy Savile case, I mean, OK, in the case of Jimmy Savile, I think there was already a critical mass of enough people who'd come forward that by the time the television programme was aired, it was pretty clear what had happened. But since then, there's been 300 odd people come forward. Well, they wouldn't have come forward if he'd not have been named. I know he's now dead, so it's slightly different, but it's the same dynamic at play. And I suspect that, you know, that same dynamic would be at play in other cases as well. So there is an argument for this. It's just that the way that it can affect the lives of the people who are accused who are innocent, maybe that's what we need to focus on. Maybe we need to focus on making sure that the reporting is fair. And you know, like for example, with what we saw in the press today with Nigel Evans, I didn't actually read any of them. But, I mean, I would hope that they would have heavily caveated those stories and made it very clear at the very start, maybe even in the headline, that, you know, they're accused and they may well be innocent. I suspect that hasn't happened. And, that, you know, people who read these stories will then be thinking, well, no smoke without fire. That's the big problem with this.
Yeah, I think if you focus on things like workplace protections, not something this government's especially good at focusing on, rather than the kind of measure that has an element of victim blaming, I think you will create better legislation. If you protect the people who are accused throughout their innocence, rather than leave those who might be able to come, close down an avenue for those who might otherwise have come forward to make accusations. I think that's the way to go about it.
Maybe. And maybe what we need is a cultural shift in that just because someone is accused of something doesn't mean that they're guilty. And I think too often there is this kind of knee-jerk default assumption that they must be really guilty. Otherwise, why are they being charged? And it isn't always the case. I think the more that we have measures in place to protect the accused in this way, unless and until they are found guilty, and then, of course, you know, then it's absolutely correct that it should be fully publicised. But before then, you know, and having measures in place to protect the jobs and all the rest of it, then maybe that's the best that we can do.
I think, wasn't there a ComRes poll as well that suggested that quite a lot of people would actually be in favour of changing this and, you know, i.e. to give anonymity? So I think, you know, it seems like there would be popular support for doing it.
But I think that's largely because of this misconception that there are a lot of false claims. And I think that needs to be absolutely battered, that misconception. You know, we need to be, that's what we should be changing, is the misconception that people are above and beyond any other crimes, massively above and beyond any other crimes, the idea of reporting rapes that didn't happen. And that's just not true. It's just not true.
Yeah,
and that's
I think
what we need to focus on.
I think what happens is that obviously it does happen occasionally. And there's been one or two high-profile cases. I think Craig Charles was accused, wasn't he, about 15 years ago.
And the Hamiltons.
Yeah, so you get the odd high-profile case, but also you get other cases that are so high-profile. Almost all of them are quite widely reported. So it's this distorting effect that you get. I mean, you get exactly the same thing with, you know, when someone dies of an ecstasy overdose, it's all over the papers for days and days and days. When someone dies of, you know, paracetamol overdose, it doesn't even get mentioned. And it's a similar sort of thing at play here, that every time one of these cases where, you know, someone accuses someone of raping, it turns out to have been a false allegation, there's massive blanket coverage. And I think people think it happens far more often than it does because of that, even though it doesn't, as you rightly say. I saw a statistic the other day, I can't remember the exact number, but there's no difference in terms of false, you know, false claims made of rape than there are about any compared to any other crime.
Okay, finally, talking about things that were in the coalition agreement that now may or may not be happening. It was announced this week that the government will not be pushing forward with the promise to legislate to ensure that 0.7% of GDP goes to our international development budget. This is something that obviously Lynn Featherstone has been pushing very, very hard for as the Lib Dem International Development Minister. What kind of fallout is that going to have within the coalition, Mark?
Well, I'm sure Lynn Featherstone will be extremely unhappy about this, because, as you rightly say, she has been pushing for this. If I can just try and understand this correctly, though, the amount of aid that's being given at the moment, is it 0.7%? Because what they're talking about here is whether that should be enshrined in law.
I think we may manage 0.7% in a year where our GDP was really low.
Yeah.
Problem is that these projects need to be planned on a long-term basis.
Yeah.
You can't sort of go, oh God, we just don't know how much we're going to give this year. It might be 0.3, it might be 0.7. And even a percentage of GDP is going to go up and down, down and down, if this government doesn't need to go by.
You can't help the little jibes, can you?
I can't, that's what I'm here for, Mark.
That's the second one, I'll let the first one go. Go on, carry on.
So, it's a problem for, it will make it bad work. You know, if you don't enshrine it, then it's the easiest thing to cut. And, you know, you can imagine that they've made certain promises this side of the next election, but were there to be a return Tory government, you can imagine that international development is going to be the first thing to go.
Possibly, but Cameron really set his stall out before the previous election. And to be fair to him, he has stuck to that pledge to ring fence foreign aid.
He also said he wasn't going to have a top-down reorganisation of the NHS. I suspect next election won't say that quite so much.
Yeah, but he did stick to the pledge about the ring fencing of the aid budget this time round. So I would suspect if Cameron was Prime Minister after 2015, I would expect if he'd promised it before the 2015 election that he'd be more likely to stick to it. But I mean, we all know that there are lots of Tory backbenchers who aren't happy with this, with that pledge, and are not happy with the fact that we're giving 0.7% in foreign aid. You know, it's the old charity begins at home thing, isn't it? To be honest, I'm not a massive fan of this tendency to legislate for things like this. I remember before the 2010 election, when Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling put some legislation in place to ensure that the deficit was halved within 4 years. And I remember thinking, why are they putting legislation in place? They can pledge to do it at an election, and if other parties don't pledge to do it, then fine. And, you know, the votes will fall where they fall. And then the manifesto will be implemented as it will be implemented. But why does it require legislation? Because if a government gets in, you can't bind the hands of your successors anyway, so they could always reverse it.
They can, but it's a lot harder to reverse once it's in law, and that helps the international development agencies to plan properly, which is what is needed. You know, international development is about long-term planning. It's not something that happens on an electoral cycle. So it's better to have some sort of long-term guarantees about what kind of money they'll be getting.
What do you think, Laura?
Well, I mean, probably just further evidence of making promises that they can't keep, and you know, a sign that perhaps the coalition isn't working and or functioning as it should be. But, you know, I kind of wonder whether they think this is a bit of a popular argument at the moment, a bit kind of jumping on the sort of popular debate, which is, you know, charity starts at home, and should we be concentrating at home rather than thinking of putting sort of funds into elsewhere, and, you know, kind of linking into this sort of jumping on the UKIP kind of side of things, which, yeah, is very much about being us and ourselves and no one else. And so I just wonder whether they're thinking of jumping on the popular debate, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? As we kind of come full circle, as we were talking about this at the start. But the idea that because Cameron decides to renege on a coalition agreement pledge to enshrine the 0.7% in law, that's going to make any difference to the people who might be thinking of voting UKIP. I mean, that's just not going to happen. You know, like you said, pandering to UKIP.
No, but it will help pander to his backbenches, which is what he's really thinking.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It's all part of the backbench management strategy, if you ask me.
Well, to come back to your previous question, I mean, I don't think this is going to split the coalition, but, you know, it is another thing that the Lib Dems are going to be very unhappy about. I don't know what they've got for this, if they've managed to trade this off for something else. I don't know, maybe it's only just been announced, hasn't it? Maybe Cameron's gone off on one and decided to, you know, bring this out during a bank holiday weekend to keep the Lib Dems on the back foot. I imagine Clegg's not very happy about it.
No, but what's he going to do?
Well, there you go. We've had this discussion many a time. He can flounce off, take his parliamentary party with him, or he can swallow it. And I suspect he'll do the latter.
Yes, I suspect so too. And on that note, I think it's time for us all to flounce off. I'd like to thank Laura Wilkes for joining us. Thank you ever so much. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
And Mark, as always, great fun.
Thank you.
And also I'd like to thank Audioboo for hosting the podcast, and Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our funky theme music. And we'll be here next week.